looking down at the landscape and thinking, wow, how do they keep these here?
Yeah.
Obviously you do.
That's good. And I see from your handout and past stuff, you know, you had some good speakers, and I think you guys are doing a really good thing. And you'll see in my presentation early this morning and then this afternoon, I repeat a lot of what you already know. So, you know, we're thinking the same things as you all, and that's good. You're over there on your stuff there. The points that are important are exactly needed to make good Queens and make good progress in a localized effort. So, I don't know, hats off to you guys for doing this. It's a really good thing. Not that many states that have an organized queen production program, and I think you guys are, you know, top three, three or four, so keep it up. I think you will find that the efforts will be well worth or that the results will be well worth the effort. So I didn't know what kind of background you had, so I made this talk to be kind of general and specific. So anytime you have a question, if you want to stop me and ask a question, that's fine. Just, you know, don't stop me too many times. I'll start to sweat and get nervous. And then afterwards, we'll have plenty of time to talk. So without further ado, I'm Adam Finkelstein. That's Kelly Rausch back there. Kelly hates to give talks, so I'm going to tease her throughout the day. Just make sure you give her a good ribbing. She's a very nice person. And we're from Maryland. We're about 30 miles north of D.C. We're going to move this winter, hopefully, to North Carolina. We're still looking for a location. That'll give us 2 months more on our season with the climate, and there are a lot less people there. So it's a lot easier to produce bees. Our biggest problem is with neighbors and their impact on our operation. So anyway, here we go. Okay, so we're basically going to talk about within an effort like this, how would one select for a varroa resistance? And there are a lot of different things, strategies you can use, but we're going to focus on what we do. And, you know, if you guys are interested in that, fine. And if you're not, that's fine too. There's more than one way to get to varroa resistance. But obviously, there is a need for mite resistance. And this slide is, you know, it's pretty simple. You know, the colonies with lots of varroa die. And the colonies that don't have a lot of varroa, some of them might die too, but the chances of them dying are much less if they don't have varroa. Varroa is a positively correlated condition for colony mortality. But it's not necessarily the varroa, it's what the varroa is doing. So we've got this triangular situation here where the honeybee is doing its thing, and then you've got the mite, which is parasitizing the honeybee. But what's really going on is the mite is spreading this, and this is viruses, because there's more than one or two. There's a whole mess of them. And as research comes up, there's more and more information about how honeybee viruses are pretty serious. But this mite, in its life cycle on the bee, is spreading the viruses, and that's the big concern. So we don't have a way yet to go in and take out viruses. We probably won't have a way to do that, even in our own physiology. When you get a virus, you don't go to the doctor, and the doctor doesn't say, here, take this for a virus. Usually it's just stay healthy and get over it. So what we're going to do instead is work on mite. And I don't have it down here, and I probably should have, but we didn't have enough time to get it in. But a couple of these slides are from a presentation that Bob Danka at the USDA Bee Breeding Lab in Baton Rouge prepared. I asked him for a few for some of this stuff. So this is one of his slides. And basically, he's very helpful. We work with him on VSH program. We'll get to that in a minute. But basically, on mite resistance, what routes are you going to take and how are you going to get there? And you basically are looking on this thing right here, which is the population growth of the mite. And you would all agree that if you have a problem with something and you can stop its spread, you can stop its growth, you're going to deal with that problem. So that's the idea with sort of the mechanics of the mite resistance, is dealing with slowing down the population growth of the mite. And you have here, you know, this is mortality with a really susceptible colony, not mortality, but the growth of the population of mites. And then if you have a really resistant mite-resistant colony, the population is going to stay low. And then this is intermediary. That's important. It's not necessarily, you know, the bees are in there like punching the mites and dragging them out. It's more the whatever's happening is keeping the population of mites from growing way too much. So what do? You've got to keep this population down. You're basically going to look at traits that you can pick out that are going to regulate this population growth. And we're going to just go through these quickly. There are some traits. A hygienic trait. And you guys over there, right on that slide, the freeze kill brood, that is for bee hygiene in a colony. So that is bees, if you pick bees that remove dead brood, you're going to get bees that remove dead brood. And that is very good, because if there's brood that's sick or ill or has some kind of problem, and the workers in the colony are removing that brood, that's a good thing. However, for mites, that's not necessarily for mite-infested brood. It's just for dead or diseased or damaged brood. But that is one way to deal with mite population growth. Hygienic bees are going to be a little bit more mite-resistant than non-hygienic bees. Grooming. So there are there's research that's being done at Purdue, and other people have done research over the years. Kelly and I did an assay a long time ago in the mid-90s where we looked at bees pulling mites off and then checking out the mites and seeing which mites, if any, were damaged, dented, or if their legs were chewed. And we found lots of dead, damaged and dented mites, and Purdue's finding a good grooming activity. So obviously that could be important. You know, if the bees are actively removing mites from other bees, that's going to enhance their overall population, their overall resistance, and lower the population growth. And then the next one is reduced mite reproduction. And this is a really important one, because this is one of the traits that VSH has a lot to do with. So within a cell, there is a whole bunch of mite biology that's going on. And the female mite is mating with a male mite, and it's having offspring, and it's doing its whole little mite life in that cell. And if your bees can do something to reduce that reproduction efficiency, so if that female mite that's in there is thwarted somehow and can't make new mites, the mite population is going to go down. And lastly, second to lastly, there is this reduced mite reproduction from the effect of the brood. And there is some research from the USDA Bee Breeding Lab within the VSH program where they don't really have something that they can point to and say, this is what's happening, but they have noticed that with the highly VSH-expressing bees, so the bees that show this VSH behavior, the actual brood itself keeps somehow the mite reproduction in check. Not with any behavior of the workers, just the brood itself. Maybe the brood somehow is chemically not attractive to the mites, or maybe somehow there's some thicker cuticle on the pupa, and it's harder for the mites to pierce it. They don't know. They're not sure yet. But that is something that has been showing up over and over again and within the data that they get. And so that's why this is listed here. And that also goes along with this brood attractiveness. So these are two brood effects, and this is a worker effect on Varroa population growth. These are all areas that one can select for. So here we go with the VSH. VSH stands for Varroa Sensitive Hygiene. Sometimes people say Varroa Specific Hygiene. I sometimes say one or the other depending on how much coffee I've had. I don't think it matters as long as it's clear that you're talking about Varroa, you're talking about specific hygienic behavior that is involved with dealing with Varroa with bees. Different than just general hygiene, this is behavior that concentrates on mite population growth reduction. So from general to specific, for resistance of mites, we're going to go through here, and we'll look at this one here. Does anybody know the sort of the pun for the natural selection method of breeding for resistance?
Bond method.
So it's called the James Bond method because it's live and let die. So basically, you've got 100 colonies. You're running them. You say, I'm going to select for mite resistance. You don't treat them. You don't do anything. And every year, whatever's left, you breed from. And if things work out right, maybe you'll have a few that seem to do well. And you keep using those and you bring in other ones that someone else is doing that with so you don't get too loaded up and too inbred. And maybe eventually you'll have some resistance. And sure, that should work. That's how traits are assorted in the whole population of bees. There's going to be a chance somewhere that there are going to be some bees that maybe naturally have VSH or naturally have something else, but it's kind of risky and it's kind of expensive, and a lot of people have a problem with watching their bees die because they're selecting for Varroa resistance. However, if you're going to make any progress, it's much easier to select for Varroa resistance if you don't treat your bees for Varroa. I mean, it just is. It's a fact. It's just obvious. We haven't treated our bees, this will be our 16th year, and we lose colonies. We lose colonies to poor health, but we don't really see the kind of effects we used to see when we first started, where the whole colony would get full of mites and then crash and burn, usually the second year. But all of our stock has high levels of VSH behavior in it, because that's all we use. So you can do it, but it is tough. So that's a general way. Some folks that are doing a program like yours will run some of their colonies specifically untreated as a test. You know, I made these queens, I got these queens traded from this cooperator, I'm going to mate them in my yard, I'm going to run them for 2 years without treatment, see what happens. Nothing wrong with that. But they might do poorly, but that's just one method. Then there's the whole concept of the Russian program. That was a solution that the USDA came up with. They were pretty smart. They said, we need mite-resistant bees, what are we going to do? And they said, they came up with the rationale is that they would find bees that already had some kind of resistance, and they would concentrate on that, and then they would look for potential resistance within the bees already here, hence VSH, hence Russia. And so the two programs kind of go hand in hand. The Russian guys do very well. I think those bees are really good. The one drawback with Russian stuff is you've got to have it pretty pure for it to show these resistant traits. If you take pure Russian stock and you cross it out to the local population, the resistance sort of goes down and down and down, and that's not so good. So you have to keep your stock fairly tight and pure, and that means you have to have a lot of colonies and you have to have a lot of isolated mating areas. So it's not Russian. The Russian program's not for everybody, but people do successful beekeeping, commercial beekeeping even, with Russian bees. It's just that it's, in a way, more difficult. And I don't know. I don't know about you, but I'm not a, I don't like the Russian bees. I like VSH bees because you can basically, with VSH, you can get VSH into any kind of phenotype, any kind of style, an Italian bee, a Carney bee, a Buckfasty kind of bee. They all can show VSH if you breed it in, whereas the Russian stuff kind of gets to be sort of this one specific type, and I don't know, they're okay. They kind of shut down when the honey flow slows, and if you're really trying to produce, that can be a problem, or if you're trying to build up stuff for numbers, the Russian bees aren't as good as some of the other ones. But they're still, it's still a good program, and people are doing very well with it. So here we go, select for traits to regulate the mite population growth, and so we get into VSH. So to go over VSH really quick, it's the hygienic removal of the mite-infested pupa. That's the main thing, and we're going to get to see a movie of this in action. Pretty awesome. Kelly and I were very happy that it worked in our PowerPoint. We were hoping that it would, and it did. We'll show that to you in a second. And then this, what I was talking about previously is that a secondary direct effect from the brood may suppress the mite reproduction. And that's still in the works. There's data that shows this to be the case, but there's no actual indicator. There's no mechanism. This is why this is working. And they're working on that now. So with a high expression of VSH, you've got low mite reproduction. It means the mites themselves are not reproducing very effectively. And the cause of that, you've got the population of mites is lower. And so if you think back a few steps, that means the chances of your bees having virus is lower. And that's a good thing. All right, so you ready? Here comes the VSH in action. All is well. So check it out. There's two different behaviors. One is this uncapping behavior that you'll see. There's the uncapping pupa. And then this is the pupil removal. Watch closely.
Oh, wow.
There you go. There's the mite. See it coming out right there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Go get him.
Yeah, it goes on this bee, and then that's when it all falls apart. That bee's not happening. That right there.
The cleanup bought off you last year, year before that. I could actually see that happening.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so I mean, it's you can even see this kind of uncapping and removal in regular colonies, but what's important with this trait is that they knew that there was a reproductive mite in there, and they uncapped this, pulled the pupa out, and they interrupted that female from doing her thing. And that's key. That's the number one mechanism for the success of VSH is that interruption of reproduction.
So what happens to that mite that she has? What happens to the mite?
Good question. Usually what happens is that mite will go on, remember how it got onto this bee? That mite will get on that bee, maybe it'll be moved to another cell and reinfest, but normally what happens is after that mite is all set up and is invested in the reproduction, and then the interruption occurs, that mite becomes basically sterile. It has a very narrow window of laying its eggs and reproducing with a male mite. And if it misses, then it can't really reproduce. It'll be in there, and it can attach again onto another bee, or it can move from cell to cell and possibly transmit more viruses. But that right there, this whole process is causing that reproductive efficiency to go down, hence lowering the population growth. And you'll see it like, you'll have a big, in Maryland, we start to see a big mite population rise in August as the honey flow tails down and the brood chambers contract a little bit. The mites kind of get the upper hand. And in our colonies, you'll see frame after frame where all the cells are uncapped and they're doing this to a lot of the brood. And it almost looks like it's a brood disease, but it's not. They're just jamming on removing the mites. And then, like in September, when they kick back in, the frames are mostly sealed up again. So.
Have you monitored the age of the pupating bee to determine about what time they discover the mite that's in there? I mean, if it was earlier, it would save resources for the bees not feeding those larvae.
I think that the main activity for the mite reproduction is right at purple eye. I don't remember what that,
that's what I was asking.
my day thing, but you can look it up. Whenever it's purple eye, when they're just starting to sclerotize, when the development of the skin is just starting, and when you do an assay to look for these non-reproductive mites, which we'll get to, that's what you do. You try to find broods of that age. It's silly to look through broods where there are no mites. So you can open up some brood from a very young pupating larva, and you'll find a mite in there, but it might be too early to tell whether she's going to reproduce or not. So you want to get it right at the optimum time, rather than trying to preempt the search. So you're finding a mite in a cell, great, but what you want to see is if she's a reproductive mite or not. Because if she's a reproductive mite, you would score that colony lower than if she was a reproductive mite and she'd been thwarted. Is that, are you following me? I think your question was, if you knew what age the mites were actively doing this stuff, you could search right around that age. And yeah, the age, I think it's 8 to 10 day old pupa. I think that, does that sound like that? It's right at purple eye. That's when you do the test. And you know, if you're doing it before, you're going to miss important stuff.
In terms of the life cycle of the varroa that I had, the internet's got a good video that talks about the life cycle of a varroa mite and a honeybee. I guess I never thought of it until just now. So she gets interrupted, but if she hadn't been interrupted, she goes through, the bee comes out, she comes out with her offspring. Does she ever lay any eggs anymore?
No.
So
she's one shot.
Okay, I thought she kept on laying.
No, she has enough resources to do it once.
Okay.
And that's the beauty of the interruption.
Okay. Right.
If you mess her up, she's done. Right. She's not.
Okay,
she's
I just, that's good.
So thanks, single Ray. Generation from the mice.
Yep.
Okay, so not constant.
I'm pretty sure that's correct. Double check me on it, but I'm pretty sure that's correct.
You said that there's a narrow window in there on the interrupting the mite queen on is there so many days in there because you know they will lay.
I don't know if it's days. I think mites are really they're we're talking about hours. I mean it's really fast. You know, like the mites turn over generation really quickly. So they know when to get into this pupa and when to start doing the reproduction. And I think that's the purpose of this test at 8 to 10 days, because that over, with experience and observation, that's when the mite will start its family. And this next slide, let me get to this next slide, we'll go over this, because you guys are asking great questions. Hats off to you, you got it. And that's terrific. Basically, this is it in a nutshell. Is you've got a reproductive mite versus a non-reproductive mite. Have you ever looked in a cell that has had a mite and seen this stuff? You know what I'm talking about? This white sort of hair-like stuff. That's mite feces. And that's a good, quick, and dirty way to see what your mite levels are, is if you look at some newly hatched brood and you look down in the empty cells, and if you're seeing this in a lot of cells, or even if you uncap a cell, and you might see this. That's just, I always do that and say, oh, I don't see a lot of mite feces, that's good. Or, oh, there's a whole bunch of mite feces, probably a lot of action going on here, and you go from there. But what you want to find is either this when you're looking for these mites, or this. Because you can score, like the way you have your testing set up with your Z-scores, you can rate your colony as being susceptible because there's a reproductive scenario going on here. You've got the mother mite, and this is a young one, and this one here is a male. So they're having a grand old time in here. That's bad. That means this colony is not interrupting the reproduction. This is non-reproductive. The cell is sealed, the pupa is in there, and you're looking in, and all you're seeing is the single mite. There might have been reproduction at one time from the signs, but this specific mite didn't produce this family. That's the test that you have to do to really find if your bees have BSH or not. And you have to look through at least 100 cells and get a yes or no. You have to see mites, and you have to say, yes, this mite has a family. It's susceptible. No, this mite does not have a family. It's not susceptible. Have you looked through 100 pupal cells lately?
No.
Have you looked through 100 pupal cells to, or enough cells to find 100 mites, which is like 500 pupal cells? That takes time. Mm-hmm. And that's the downfall of selecting for VSH behavior, is that this is the simplest method and it takes a lot of time. So, this inhibition of mite reproduction, that is what we're talking about here, okay? That's the test that is the easiest to perform. There's another test you can do, which I don't know if you'd like the sound of this, it's pretty crazy, but you can catch and farm a bunch of mites and have them, and then you could set up some colonies, you know, all about the same size, your test queens in there, and you can inject your 50 mites into each one of the colonies. And then after a week, test to see the levels of Varroa infestation. A BSH colony will have a lower level of infestation. They'll actually remove the mites, and there will not be a lot of reproduction going on. A susceptible colony, those mites will be doing this. I don't know about you, but I'd rather count the 500 cells than farm the Varroa mites. So I'll leave the farming of the Varroa mites to Baton Rouge. That's a lot of work. So the point with all this is that this VSH is not yet easy to select for. And what is being worked on are some genetic markers that will be turned into a kit so that you will have a colony and you'll be able to say, this one might be a good candidate. It's got good honey production. It's got good low swarming. It overwintered well. And, you know, you could crush up 50 bees, do whatever the assay said or send it off, and they could use a molecular test, and it would show, yes, indeed, the area for BSH is on, and it is going to be a good candidate, or the test could say, no, this one doesn't have BSH. That's in the works. And I think we should see that, something like that, maybe in the next 5 years. Who knows? But they're actively working on it. The idea with that is you wouldn't have to do this shenanigans. We sometimes do this, and we're going to be doing more of this counting because being in business, it's good to have your eggs covered, you know, your basket of eggs covered. And if Baton Rouge, for some reason, stops getting funding and VSH stops, it would be good to continue to select for VSH without their help. It's just between the two of us, Kelly and I, and this mite counting, we just don't have enough hours in the day to do it. So when I get breeding stock from Baton Rouge and it says pure VSH, I assume they have done this already. And from the results, I would have to say, yes, indeed, they have. So anyway, little or no varroa population growth results when greater than 75% of the mites are non-reproductive. So if you're doing this test and doing the counting and you find 75% of your count is this, that is going to keep the varroa population growth in check. A third of the mites did not lay eggs, did not oviposit. We didn't really go over that. There's a different assay for that. But basically, one can assume the non-reproductive would also be the non-egg-lay. So if you're finding a third that are in here in this non-reproductive state and never, ever, ever had a family, that is the third. And I don't know if we have that assay or not. I don't know what that assay is from. But basically, I think that this is another way to look at this non-reproductive. Because if something is not laying eggs, it's definitely not reproductive. But you don't have a slide to actually show this open position. And then the last thing is 7 out of 10 of the mite-infested pupa are removed in 1 week. That's the mite farming, you know, where you've actually got to inoculate the colonies with live mites, wait for the varroa to infest them, and then see if 7 out of 10 infested pupa are removed. That one is left for Baton Rouge to do. I don't know how anybody can do that unless they really had a lot of time on hand. But anyway, if I was going to give you, in a nutshell, how to use VSH, this is the slide. Everything in selecting for VSH for practical purposes is in this slide. So you guys, you understand the concept of the non-reproductive versus reproductive. I mean, it's, and the movement where the bees are actually performing a behavior that's causing the mite to not reproduce. That's what we're after.
That's what you're saying. The non-reproductive is that they've interrupted it. Otherwise,
they've interrupted it. They've in a combination with the removal behavior and the opening up the cell and the change in the condition for that reproductive mite, something happens and it's not reproducing. That's VSH.
But that doesn't have anything to do with the harder skin potentially of the larva itself you were talking about.
No, that's so that, this is what you can actually test. You know, it's a lot of work, but you can go out there and you can look at all these different infested bees and you can say, there's a family, negative, oh, here's one where there's no family, positive, and then you just look at them side by side and do a, you know, turn it into a percentage, and if you've got a higher percentage where there's no family, you're on the road to mite resistance. That's in your backyard or your bee yard.
I might be under the misinterpretation information I have, but I was assuming their understanding that what you need to do is just give the bees a slight advantage in production, and they might out-survive the mite. And where the problem is when bees start shutting down, the mites are continuing on, and they overtake that reproduction cycle. So if the mite is actually getting a gain of about 10% in every cycle, basically. And if you interrupt enough of them and keep it down at a one-to-one ratio or less than, you're ahead of the game when you go into winter. So you just have to kind of put them at a disadvantage, the mites, and the bees will gain the upper hand. Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to be abundant about this. The bees aren't, but they might be able to deal with it.
Sure. What he's saying is you're almost in a way talking about the way Russian bees mechanism works, where somehow the Russian bees break the brood cycle. They cause the mites to not get ahead of the bees. And that's absolutely right. However, if you're a commercial beekeeper and you have over 1,000 colonies, how are you going to go out to those 1,000 colonies and do what needs to be done to interrupt the growth?
Well, isn't that what splitting does and swarming does? Is that breaks that brood cycle and they start 5, over again?
5,000 colonies, they're in 3 different states. You can't do that.
I'm going to go pinch all my queens in my hives.
No.
For this to be economically effective for everybody, it's got to be in the bees. They've got to do it on their own. your methodology is a cultural control. It's perfect. There's no problem that it's IPM. If you're doing something that's non-chemical, it's non-invasive, you're managing your bees, that's great. You're absolutely right. And a good beekeeper can do that. But for getting a queen, using it in a scenario where that's one of your animals in your herd, you've got to have it built in so that it's happening already. It's got to be in the bee itself. And then, you know, if you're going to do extra work, great. But you want, I would rather have that resistance in my stock as well as to perform the culture stuff. That's the difference. But you're right. And that's management for a varroa. You don't need to have the magic chemical bullet. There's lots of things you can do. And if you're of, you know, if you believe that you would rather do that and put less foreign material in your bees, it works fine. You just have to keep up on it, make sure they have enough stores when you split them. A lot of times people do that, they split their bees, and then the splits starve because there's not enough resources. So you've taken something that's okay, and you've made it less than okay by breaking it in half. So, you know, you've got to be pretty wise about all that.
Isn't that what also happens with the Africanized bees, the constant swarming kind of, it's kind of like they're leaving a dirty house
African
and
bees,
moving on?
African bees don't really do anything other than quickly make brood and then leave. There's no comb really hanging around. They're so busy swarming and moving on that the mite doesn't have a chance to
catch
up.
Right.
Good question. Anybody else?
When you're examining this, is it best to use worker cells?
Yes, definitely workers. You're looking at workers. Drone, you have to assume there are mites in there, and there will be all the time. But that's where they would go first. So this is in workers. Good question.
In VHS, is it hard to keep drones? Would they be tearing drones out quite a bit?
You know, that's a really good question. What we find in our colonies, if we're after drones, because that's how we get our semen. I mean, you know, can't do AI without drones. It almost seems like the population never gets big enough for them to start heading into the drones. And so they don't drag out, they don't uncap too many drones. It's mostly the uncapping in the worker group. That's a good question. All right, well, you see a little drone uncapping, but they mainly, if they're going to be doing lots of uncapping, it's in the main brood net.
Well, I got to back, you just started another question. So you got 16 days on the queen and 28 or whatever for the drone, and they prefer the drone, and I was thinking because there's more time in there to the potential to have success on laying a few more eggs or whatever. And what about the queen? She's a 16. Do you ever see varroa on a queen?
I've never seen varroa. His question is, have we ever seen varroa in a queen larva? Well, I've seen a varroa, an adult mite on a queen. Actually, this year I saw one on a queen. But no, but then again, you know, our queen stuff is so manipulated, and, you know, with cell building and all that, that you're on top of that all the time, and I don't know. I've never seen varroa mites in queen pupas, but I think it's too short. I think they cycle through too quickly. For the mite to do this stuff, I think it's way too fast.
Okay, so what if you had a worker that did 19 days instead of 21? Well, that'd make a difference?
That's one of the things that they were originally selecting for. He's asking about other ways that varroa mites could be thwarted in their population growth, and he's talking about development time. So if you had a worker bee that actually developed a little bit more quickly, wouldn't that cause the varroa mite to slow its growth? And they selected for that. And actually, there was some of the early VSH stuff also had earlier selection time, and it was hard to make queens from that because they were always hatching out at weird times and virgins were getting out too early. And so that was in there for a while. And we'll see that occasionally. You know, you'll get one that comes out earlier, a day earlier, and you follow the timetable. So, yeah, that's true, too. It's a good point.
Yeah. Say, Apis serena, the original host of the varroa, their workers come out earlier than
Apis mellifera. So that's one of their controls, was one of their controls about the raw.
Yep. That's right.
And I don't remember if it's days earlier or just hours earlier, but it's enough.
I think it's earlier.
Yes, it's enough that they can't produce good enough to make a difference.
Everything in green here is just a work bee sitting in there long enough for the varroa to fully develop. So if you eliminate your drone brood, you help control your mites. But you're saying that the varroa is in with the worker bee, so does it actually have enough time in there to fully develop the mite or not?
In with the worker.
Yeah, sure. So you're saying, assuming that drone brood is the most optimum, and you take the drone brood away, is then there going to be a place for the varroa to exist in the worker brood? Yeah. I mean, certainly. They can do just fine in worker brood. I think they prefer drone brood, but then again, after years of, I mean, we actually grow drones. We have, every colony of ours gets 3 frames of drone comb, because we need those drones. I don't see that many. If I'm going to see varroa mites, it's usually in the workers. I don't know.
Well, isn't the difference there is in a drone brood, the 24 day gives them the ability to raise 5 offspring, and in the workers, it's like 3.5. We don't get half.
Yeah.
Varroa, but
And that's, and they prefer, it's optimum. Drone brood is optimum, but they're opportunistic. They're going to go wherever they go. So.
How long does the mite actually live?
Once it's hatched and does its thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a good question. Probably long enough to, some will overwinter. So they're probably like very similar. It's, they're similar to insects.
No, spiders.
they probably have different metabolisms based on the conditions, and they can probably shut down and sort of hang on to a bee all winter and then kick in. But like an active reproductive mite, how long would it live? Probably no more than 30 days. Probably what it does is after it does this, that's it, and it's done. Because it's going to have very few resources left. So assuming that it's 24 days for a drone, so maybe 30 days, I don't know. That's a great question. I'll have to look it up. So, jumping from all that VSH stuff into you guys, we're going to talk about some of this other practical methodology. So, alcohol wash, sugar shake, ether roll, some people will even do the dusting. Basically, you can select a little bit of for varroa levels and varroa resistance without all the counting by running these alcohol wash tests and their variants. You're finding phoretic mites. You're finding mites that are not reproducing. You're finding the mites that are riding on the bees. So that's different than actual reproductive mites. So whether that is significant or not, we don't really know, but if you consistently get alcohol washes and you have a very low level of mites riding around on bees, you can extrapolate from that to say that the mite population in that colony is lower than if you're finding, huge levels of mites hitchhiking on bees.
Are you saying that doing mite count on drone cells is sufficient or not?
I would not do mite count on drone cells. What are you basing that on? I mean, how one colony could have more drone brood than another. One colony could have more susceptible drone brood than another. You'd have to come up with a framework and say 0 to X number of mites per this many drone cells is okay, and over that is too much. And that's kind of, I don't know if anybody's done that or not. Whereas if you're just, maybe that's something to work on. I just would interject that we don't find as many. If we're going to find varroa, we find it more in the workers. They just don't go in the drones as much in our colonies. Now, but you know, we've got VSH and we've been selecting for all this time. Maybe that's a result of VSH. I don't know. But either way, if you do an alcohol wash and you're getting some drones in there and they've got mites on them, they'll show up in the alcohol wash test. So it'll give you the chance to see what the hitchhiking phoretic mite load is and the mite population growth. So this is really important right here. I get people that call me up and say, I got great bees, I did an alcohol wash, and I got 3 mites per 100 bees. And I say, how many tests did you do? And they say, 1 test. And I say, go back to the drawing board and do some more tests. Because as the mite population level goes like that, you're going to possibly catch them maybe in a low trough or in a high peak. So if you have an average of over the season, and there you go, using the Z-score where you can standardize with time, you can come up with a level that's good. And if your bees are under that level, you use them. If they're not, you shut them. The average, we use 3. And with 3 over the year, if we get below 7 mites per 100 bees, that's what we use. If I get an average of 7 mites per 100 bees or less, I can continue to use those kind of crosses. If I get a higher level, I'm not going to use those, or I'm going to watch those for susceptibility issues. Is that clear? You get that? And this is on the internet, and you guys have a couple people have got SARA grants. This is a SARA grant, but basically it's, you know, this is it, step by step. There's an alcohol thing in there, and I'm just going through in the active brood nest and getting a sample of bees, and you kill bees doing this. You do kill them, and some people are totally opposed to this test because they don't want to kill bees. I understand. We do this because you can sample 100 colonies, and those bees can sit for 2 weeks in their mason jar. You don't have to do it all at once. So you can get data and then analyze it later. There's a sample. There's a white bowl with a screen and a hose and the sample. And this is not rocket science. Bees go in the sieve, spray the bees. We do it 3 times. So we do this 1 spray, then count the number of mites that come off, another spray, and a 3rd spray. And there you go. So that's that. That was 4 mites in that 1 spray. If this was the total for that sample, this would be a good colony. And sometimes it's a lot more than that. Also, you get like little pieces of bee feces, and sometimes a hind gut of a bee will get sprayed. So you got to make sure you're counting the actual mites.
Luke, a question. You said, it's a snapshot in time. So are you doing a spring, summer, fall test? So that you have, you can follow the trend of,
or, you know, late buildup, so after spring, so like maybe right at the end of the honey flow, and then like sort of when they're starting to contract, you know, hunker down after the main season, and then fall when the, you know, you want to see what the ratio is with your feeding or whatever. And that average, that's like a nice wide spread. If you did it every month, it would be more accurate because then you'd have a truer picture. The more testing you do, the better the data is. It's just time, you know, as we all know, you know, who has enough time? Nobody. Especially when you're working with bees. Mm-hmm. It's all time. You know, if you miss, you miss. We all know that. So this test basically is, you know, the total mites found divided by the total bees times 100 will give you percentage of the mites. And then here, you know, you got to do it more than one time. And there's Kelly counting the bees. Her favorite job. So we're going to review some of this VSH selection.
You don't either weigh or by volume, you actually individually count.
I'll give you some history on that. So This test started from a guy who's retired now, who is at Tucson, at the Tucson Bee Lab. And he wrote two papers, and they're pretty much ignored. And then other people sort of did it on their own and started to select for Varroa resistance, just using the alcohol wash. It makes sense, you know? If you're going to pick from the colonies that have less mites, the chances of you producing bees with less mites is going to be somewhat positive. And then this got to be sort of more popularized. We did our grant thing. Some other people worked with it. And commercial beekeepers were like, I can't do that. You know, so Spivak, I think, came up with a weighing where, you know, you, to standardize sampling, you just go for a weight rather than trying to count. And you assume you make an index that X weight is 100 bees. Mm-hmm. That's where the weighting comes in. I don't know. We just have always done it this way, so we do it that way. I mean, it's the same idea. And then there's a contraption where you have, like, you can scoop and then you turn it this way and it goes right in and then you can shake it back and forth. Mm-hmm. There's that too. That's, you know, beekeepers, everybody's got to come up with their own method to do something. Mm-hmm. There you go. It's the same, the outcome is the same.
Okay.
So, the most effective mite selection is that USDA style reproductive test with accounting the mites that are in reproductive mode and seeing if they're reproducing or not. That's going to show you if you have a level of BSH behavior more quickly than anything else. But that is difficult and time consuming. The alcohol wash is easy to perform. It doesn't actually show the BSH behavior though, but it does show you your level of mites that aren't in cells, mites that are traveling around on the bees. And if you can do both together, that's going to give you both a reproductive VSH, varroa-specific hygiene test, and population test, and that's really good. And that's where, as a group, if you guys coordinated, maybe, you know, you could pool your information, so rather than having to do all the testing yourself, you could share information. And then with that information, do your selections. That's where group stuff comes in and distributes the time. And that's a good thing. So this is on the USDA slide. It's pretty effective. It shows it pretty well. So bees that were pure VSH, and look at the number of mites they removed. And then this is a cross of pure VSH out. And then these are two commercials, assuming that the infestation was the same. Now that is a pretty big difference. Mm-hmm. And you can't argue with that. It's straight numbers. So, and in 1 week. All right. So, jumping from VSH, we're going to get to the world of practicality. So the USDA with the VSH program basically had to say, okay, we have this great thing, but how the heck is it going to help beekeepers? You know, they can't do this. Especially the beekeepers that are actually earning their livings doing bees migratory style. Those are the guys who we should be serving before we serve anybody else. Hobbyists are great, that's great, that's cool, but who are the real farmers with the bees? They're the migratory guys. So what they did was they came up with this Paul line concept. And it's a very good concept because it really works. And the idea was to take, you know, really good commercial bees that did well and that were proven and cross them with bees that had high VSH and come up with a mix that had both mite resistance and desirable characteristics to be productive. And that's what the Paul line is. And we get pawline from the USDA, but we also basically, by taking VSH stock and crossing it to other good stock, we're sort of making our own pawline. And you all, if you're buying VSH breeder queens and you're crossing it out, you're in a way getting pawline. The idea of pawline is basically getting the VSH trait into the general population. So this is, I think, really shows the foresight of the bee lab, and this is what they did. So they worked with three cooperators. The first guys over here in the east coast of Merrimack Valley Apiaries. They're a small operation. They have 80,000 or so colonies. A little operation. You know, and they go, they overwinter in Mississippi, and then they go up and they do all this pollination, and then they hit blueberries, and then they go out to western New York, where there's a lot of goldenrod, and they put weight on for that, and then they go back down here. I think they also go out to the almonds too. But that's one person that was in, the one operation that was involved in pawline. Then the central guy, who we know real well, we work with him often, Lamb Honey Farms. He lives in Minnesota, but he has an operation in East Texas, and then he does honey in North Dakota. And I talked to him, and I was asking him about his management, and he said, well, you know, if you get any stock from me, it's going to be pretty good, because I abuse the heck out of my bees, and if they live, they're going to be pretty hardy. And I thought, okay, this guy's pretty honest. Let's, you know, see what it's like, and his bees are really good.
He does 180,000 queen cells.
Yeah, in spring.
Wow.
His bees are excellent. Yeah. He's a really nice guy. He's if you ever meet him, you'll know it before you see him because he's very loud. He talks very loud. And then the last cooperator was Adi, and they're the largest beekeeper in the country. I think they are over 100,000, 120,000. And they go and they do the honey, they do the almonds, and then they overwinter in, I think they're in Mississippi too. So the idea was, let's take these VSH queens, we're going to put them out in these guys' operations, and we're going to see how they do. And then, they took queens from each one of these operations and mated them to VSH. And then they put them back into their operations and ran them for a year. And so I think they were like, 120 or 130 per operation. And at the end of that year, they got the information on those 130 and the best two or three from each one. They then used as breeder queens for the next year. And they did that a few years. And so what you're getting is you're getting this kind of commercial treatment and you're getting low mite counts and you're getting high honey production and survivability. And this is what they broke it down to be. Obviously, if the colony died, that's not good for breeding. They wanted a large bee population, and they're low varroa, and they wanted them to make honey. So out of this effort came these pawline queens, and people have been very happy with them. They didn't select for color. They didn't select for sensitivity to feed, although most commercial bees are very sensitive to feed. And what I mean by sensitivity to feed, if you're commercial, you want to have a colony and you feed it, you want it to make brood really fast. You want it to build up. Sometimes for a hobbyist or someone who's just starting out, you don't want that. You don't want a really sensitive colony because they'll eat up all their stores. You want a more gentle reaction to feed. But if you're trying to make more bees, you want to feed them and you want them to make turn that into brood really fast. And if they're really good bees, you also want them to not eat up all their food. That's the best. So you want it a little bit of everything. And these are very successful, and we produce a lot of these pawlines, more probably than pure VSH. Because basically this is practical. The pure VSH, certainly it's going to enhance your VSH levels in your operation, but they're not as hardy as these because they've been bred for one thing for a really long time. Pawlines are all around very good. So jumping to someone like you, some organization like yours, you know all this, but I'll just go over it anyway. Obviously, you want to use stuff that's going to work here. You don't want to pick bees that are really light yellow and produce 10 frames of brood in 3 weeks, and then if they run out of feed, they die. You don't want those bees, especially seeing how it is right now. With the wind and stuff, I mean, you would have to feed those bees all year round. So you don't want that. You want a bee that can hold its own. And so that's very important. Some people don't get that. They ask for bees that are super productive, and then they don't understand why they didn't do well without feeding. I don't know. What goes in comes out. You also want to have stock that's hygienic, and you guys are doing that with your freeze kill brood testing. And it would be really nice if you could get some BSH in there too. That's going to keep your mite populations down automatically. And, you know, there's appropriate phenotypes. We sell pretty much three kinds of bees. We sell a bee that does well in the north. So at the end of the season, there's enough honey for the bee to overwinter. We sell a bee that is a good honey producer that you might have to feed or you might not, depending on your year. And then we sell bees that all the people want is brood. And those bees are crazy productive. But if you don't feed them constantly, they die. Those are almond pollination bees. Literally, I have customers that say, I don't care what they're like. I want them to be light yellow and I want them to produce a lot of brood. And we sell a lot of those, so obviously they're doing something with them. But I couldn't keep those bees. You know, they would starve, because after a certain period of time, I'm not going to go out and feed my bees anymore. But there is a limit to what I'm going to do. You know, so, and we're not moving our bees south to overwinter them. So this is important. So obviously in this area, there's a combination of traits that's going to give you a good, solid bee. And you, that's up to you to figure out, and I think you're working on that. Here's a slide of a technician from the USDA out in the southern San Joaquin Valley. This is just to give you an example of what's involved in breeding and selection. I don't know this guy personally, but I know that he's probably wishing he was somewhere else in this picture, because I think it was really warm, and then all of a sudden, you know, some storm came in. It was like, what was it like in, when was it, in May or April or something? Yeah, and so it started to snow on him as he was out there. So, you know, you got to be dedicated. We have a program that we do a little bit of breeding with people on the internet. It's a web-based group, and we trade stock back and forth, not unlike you guys. And some of the people, they don't understand that you have to prioritize, and if you want to make progress in bee breeding, you've got to, instead of watching TV or, you know, going out to eat, you've got to go out and get those queens and bring them in. You know, you've got to put a lot of work into it. There's a lot of work in bee breeding. And I know you all are hardworking, but I have to bring that up, because sometimes people think, you know, oh yeah, I'm going to breed some bees, you know, no problem. And then the bees are all dead. And you really have to take some care and time in what you're doing. And some, you know, be mindful that it takes a lot of work. So this is a great one. If you get 500 queens to test, and you get one or two or 10 that are really good, you've got something. If you're testing one queen out of 10, you got to keep going. I mean, the chances of you getting something really good out of 10 queens, not so much. But if you know, you're working with 500 and you get one or two that are really good, that's going to be pretty accurate. And that's something to think about. You have strength in numbers whenever you're selecting and breeding. The more of you cooperating in this program and trading stuff back and forth, the faster you're going to get something that's really good or better than what you've already done. And yeah, use common sense when choosing stock to work with. You're obviously not going to want to get, you know, really high producing southern bees to try to overwinter them here. It's just not going to happen. Following consistencies. I had some other wording in here that was a little bit more honest. Basically what I'm saying is the people that have been around and have a good reputation, work with those people. You know, there's a lot of rising and falling in the bee world over the years, and you know, who's really popular one year ends up disappearing the next year. Work with the people that have a good reputation and that you can trust. Again, this is Lamb Honey Farm. This is like a holding our dram. I think he had 100 colonies in there. We picked a few breeders out of here. And this is nothing, you know. This is just like one of his many yards. He makes really good queens versus this. This is somebody's whole kit and caboodle, and that colony there has the best breeder queen he's ever seen. You're just not going to get much with this. However, if you work here with 20 other people, you're going to get something. And the testing is only as valid as the test size. So the more comparison you can do, the more testing you can do, the more chances of, the more good queens you make and then mate and look at the results, the better your stuff's going to be. We'll go over this stuff pretty quick because it's pretty obvious. It's just performance evaluation. You've got it all covered in your you know, your guidelines.
Yeah, I have a question real quick. Is your entire operation based on Live and Let Die, though?
It's ours.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're not treating at all?
No.
Nothing.
No, if I get, okay. I didn't do it this year because I was really busy, but every year, besides this year, I like to get 30, 40 queens from people all over the country. Make a split, put them in, see what they do.
Grow mites.
Grow mites, exactly. All and right. Invariably, those colonies never make it past August. They die.
The following year?
No.
Oh, that year. Okay.
I'm amazed at how susceptible some of the commercial stuff is. And I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to say who it is because I've tried a lot of different stuff. But it's really amazing how poorly they do. But we've got a lot of mites and high pressure. And we're not treated. So it's good to do that. And you guys would do the same thing, is that you don't necessarily have to run untreated in everything, but if you can do some stuff that's untreated, or maybe one treatment, and you know, have that as your guideline, we're going to treat it the most susceptible time, which I would think would be like end of the summer. Does that sound good to you? You know, something like that. That would be your yearly treatment, and then anything that does well under that scenario, that's a problem. You use that. But, good question. But, you know, this is just obvious selection stuff. Figure out a way to measure, rating, you've got all that. Take multiple measurements over time, because the more measurements you have, the more accurate you're going to be. You can use a spreadsheet and keep track of stuff. And something over there that I was really happy to see is that it says, I think it says, keep records, keep records, keep records. Absolutely. You can't imagine how this happens to me. This happens to me like 35, 40 times a year. I'll get a call. Hey, that breeder queen that I got from you really was good. I want to get 5 more. And I go, awesome. What was the queen's code? Huh? Every cage we send out, we have a code on it. So now what we started to do, it takes extra time, is we write, you know, everything we send out. I write down everything about it so that I have a record of every customer's stuff. How can you know anything if all you get is, well, it's nice to get a compliment, sure, but if I knew what that was, I would know the cross, I'd know the history, I'd know 4 generations back. Same is true the other way, and I get plenty of these calls too. Hey, those 2 queens I got from you were great, but this one was terrible. What did you do? Oh yeah, that sounds bad. We'll make you another one, give you credit. And then I look that code up, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. There were 2 other calls about that cross. Okay, there's something going on there. You have all that information. Record keeping, it's a little extra step, but it really works. I even resort to, I have a permanent marker. If I forget my pad or whatever, I write on my hand. A friend of mine has this really cool thing. It's a digital voice recorder, and carries it around and runs a battery, and he just talks into it. thinking about getting one of those.
Get one.
I have a dumb phone. And then this right here is really important. If a number falls off of a queen and I don't know who it is, that's it. I don't use it. If there is an unmarked queen in a colony, I don't use it. I don't read from it. If I don't like a colony, if it's starting to show a sign of something, we don't use it. We have a lot of other good potentials, but this is also how you can make progress, is pull out what isn't good or you don't know about. We all know how much we like that queen, even though she doesn't have the mark. Oh, it's a great queen. Look at how nice she looks. Well, let's use it. Don't do that. If you don't know what it is, don't use it. Or use it, but don't breed from it. And some available varroa resistant stock. Do you know who this is with Kelly? You may know that who that is. That's Tom Glenn. So from many years. So when he retired, we went out and hung out with him for a couple days, and he showed us everything he did, and he was very nice. Nice guy. And here again, don't be shy about getting stock. Ask for references. There's nothing wrong with calling when you're thinking about getting some stock or some queens. You can grill that person. If they're vague or if they say, you know, we pick from the best queens that get up early. I had one guy tell me that. They get up early. I was like, what is that? They get up early. Okay. We didn't use his queens. I want to know how they're doing, why they're good, and what steps the person's taking. And there are enough people making queens so that you can get really good queens if the people are producing them. But don't be shy. Ask for references. People ask me for references, and if I'm going to give references, I contact the customer and say, may I use you as a reference? And they say, sure. Some say no, but most say sure, and then I give a reference. And work with a group doing this. The more you have, much more power and chance of success if you work with a bunch of people. And this right here is not the topic of this talk, but it sounds like from a bunch of your background is that you will have a good chance to follow up on this. No matter what you do, if you produce your own queens and you're grafting pretty much from anything and you make a quality queen following all the principles of biology, that queen is going to be pretty darn good, and you'll be pretty amazed at how productive she will be. It's not that hard to do, and you all seem like the people that make queens here know the steps. We didn't go into any of that, but there's a huge difference in a properly made queen versus a poorly made queen. So if you're doing all this fancy breeding work and then you're producing not the best queens, sort of what's the point? So make sure that your queen production is up to snuff. And work in a, you can work together. You can have cool resources for some, you know, queen rearing, and then break it down after the queens are made to test, however you want to do it, if you want to. And that's the take, that's the feel good shot. This was in South Central Virginia to the east of the Blue Ridge Mountains. This guy had this place. It was a gorgeous place. There's his bee yard. And he approached me and he wanted to mate some queens down here because he had this isolation and he had been using VSH stock for 3 or 4 years. So I made, 30 virgins. And we took them down, we drove down here, and we put them out, and then after they made it, he took 15 and I took 15, and we tested them. And it was funny, the next year he sold his place and moved, because I think he was worried about his health, and he just completely got out of all this. And I didn't really, it caught me by surprise, because I was ready to keep doing this. It was a great ride and beautiful spot. He's a really nice guy. But this is the kind of thing you can do too. If you have, I don't know how you would do it here where there's not much of this, but there's probably some area where you could make some kind of drone congregation area. And, you know, saturate the drones and then mate in that area. I'm sure you could do that, and that's good too. So, anyway, that's it. Questions?
I have a question. Keep hearing about breeder queen. For somebody like me, I take my best queen. The bees seem to be healthy, winter, have good production, total health. Is there any more advantage buying holding breeder queen than using my best hive in the year?
I think you answered your own question. If you've got everything that you like, other than curiosity, if you're working on something and you like what it is and it's doing well, no. You could get to a point in the future where your population, so think of it as like a cloud,
right,
that you're breeding in, is starting to get saturated.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That might be when you'd want to get some new stock in. But you don't necessarily have to get a breeder queen. You could get, and this is a secret that I'll let you in on, if you buy 20 queens from any queen producer, one of those 20 is probably going to be pretty darn good, if not more. You know, as maybe not as mite resistant as some of our AI stuff, but certainly as productive. You know, because the chances of it, you know, 1 in 20, maybe 1 in 30. So, you know, you'd split an order with somebody, you'd get 15, they get 15, and if one of those was really good, then you'd add that into your existing program. And that blending in and moving about of genetic resources from one population to another, that's bee breeding. You know, it's like, you've got to bring stuff in eventually, just from the bee biology, the way bees express their sex inheritance. It's genetic, it's not chromosomal, so after so many iterations of crossing and you're narrowing in, you're getting what you want. You're also selecting for that sex area to be homozygous, which gives you that expression of a whole, and that's your pattern. So if you're a successful bee breeder, you're eventually going to get not as good pattern. You'll have what you want. Then you have to go back out a little bit and add some new stuff in. So you can do that, isolate it over time. And that's why working together is really good, because everybody is sort of doing that on their own, and by trading stock, you're keeping what you want there, but you're bringing in new stuff, and that's the balance. But
so you can actually get hybrid vigor within the VSH stock.
Oh yeah,
is what you were really saying.
Well, sure, because VSH is just one trait. Yeah. That concept of a VSH queen, you can have a queen that's Italian and has an Italian brood nest, and you got to feed like crazy and makes a ton of brood. It can have high VSH, and you can have this, you know, overwinter in a fist-sized ball carny that then explodes once the pollen comes in, and that can have high VSH too. They're two totally different phenotypes, but they do have the ability, the propensity for that VSH behavior. That's why VSH was a good idea. You could add it into what you already had. So, you know, there's no VSH queen. Some are striped, some are big, some are tiny, some are worthless. some are great, yeah. You know.
I've got a question. When you artificially inseminate or they do it naturally, there's a lot of different sperm from a lot of different drones. And you get some bees that are really defensive, and they're defensive for 4 or 5 years. Is the sperm every other one from a mean drone or a defensive drone, or how does that work?
Same thing
with PSH, if you...
That's a good question. So basically, your question sort of genetically boils down to how is aggressive behavior expressed genetically? And I don't remember exactly, but basically, if you don't want aggressive behavior, don't breed from aggressive bees. So what we do is, if there's anybody that's hot at all, now we use a little smoke, and I wear a veil. I've literally had people call me up and say our bees are too hot, And then with some questioning, I find out that they're going out in the morning, they're cracking the lid without a veil and no smoke. And it's like, wait a minute, like, why don't you try using a little smoke and wear a veil? And then they're like, oh, I'm sorry, my bad. But not using anything that's aggressive is one way. Another, you know, and then I think your brother Adam even talked about, like, in some of his discussions, how initially you could have some very aggressive crosses, and then in the further crosses, the bees would become gentle. And that's very true, but the propensity for that to show up again is there. Obviously, if it's there, it's not there, it's there, it's gonna continue to show up. So we just cull anything that's hot and don't use it. And it's hard, because sometimes you have some really good stock, but they're a little bit too aggressive.
I started that like 4 years ago. Anything that was aggressive, I'd get rid of. And I can tell a big difference. Since last year, I had more time than
we had to get rid of. Is it too mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, the expression that you're talking about, it's also based on the genetic mechanism. So, for example, I know with VSH, the theory is that it's two different genes doing stuff. So not only is it, you know, one combination, but it's another combination as well, and then all the different phases of that combination. So, you know, mathematically, that's like some very large number. And if you have so many, you'll have VSH expression. If you have in between, you'll have VSH expression, but it won't be high, and then not enough will be low. And so with that, you're just amplifying. You're trying to use VSH with every cross you make so that you're always using something with VSH in it, so that if anything, it's going to be constant, if not amplified. So it's the opposite of breeding for, you know, culling for aggression. You try to always use VSH, always use VSH. And that's the beauty of VSH. If he has a VSH stock and he's running one type of bee, and he has VSH stock and he's running another type of bee, but you cross them, you're going to get a hybrid for the general characteristics, but you're also going to get, you know, surely there's going to be lots of VSH in there because they both have VSH. So that's the idea with just the VSH, is that's, as long as you're using it off and on throughout your years, it's going to be around. As far as the different drones with aggressiveness, I think the way it works with bee biology is that it's not so much that the bee is aggressive, it's that it's sensitive to alarm pheromone. So really aggressive bees, when they smell alarm pheromone, they make alarm pheromone and they rile everybody else up. Whereas gentle bees, they'll smell alarm pheromone and it takes like a constant level or a large amount before they act. So it's the releasing behavior. So you want to select for bees that are very tolerant to that.
Can some of that be environmental, skunks?
Of course.
Right?
And that's the point of that.
Smoke in the...
That's the point of that five colonies, you know, as your selection pool. What if there's a skunk there? You're going to assume that all those five colonies are mean. Whereas if you're working from a pool of 500 colonies,
right,
there's not going to be any skunk in all of them.
Right.
Okay.
I have a question just on the genetic part of this.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any traits that are more dominant than others?
Yeah. I mean, there's with the inheritance, there's dominant and recessive. That's one system, and that's a very simple system. And, you know, as more and more research has been happening with genetics, we realize that that's like very high level top layer. And it's all this other stuff, all this modifying stuff, and all this, that there's a presence of one gene in or one control area, and then everything else, you'll get one thing, and if it's gone, you'll get another thing. But yes, some is more dominant than other. Color is a good example of that. If I, and I get this a lot, I need to have light bees, you know? No, I mean,
pretty bees.
People get mad if they're not light. No workers are not light, and I have to make them another queen. So if they want light bees, we use a light version. And you pick drones that have very little striping, and you just use those, and you'll get beautiful light bees. As far as how that works genetically, nobody knows yet, but that's certainly some kind of dominance going on. where, you know, you've got this expression that's light, so you're seeing it come out.
I have just a question for you that's simple. I got one tweet this year that she's a freak. She is throwing 5 different colors. Usually they'll shade one way or the other, but she is throwing 5 distinct colors. I got blondies, I got browns, brown with the 3 bands, I got pitch black, black with yellow stripes. And I thought, well, these must have got mixed up in the new all year long.
Different. Yeah.
I mean, I thought that was what was supposed to happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's true. He said it's, you know, that it's not on the queen, but it's also the drones. And so in the queen's spermatheca, there's a 1 microliter of sperm. Now, that's a lot of sperm. And so however many drones' sperm got in there, remember with a drone, every single sperm that a drone produces is exactly the same genetically. So you'll get strings in the spermatheca, because that's the way the sperm comes out. It sort of chains up. So the queen will have a run of like 15, 20, 30 eggs, and it'll all be that one chain. And then maybe it'll switch to a different chain. And so you'll get variations, and you can watch them change over the season. And, you know, sometimes it's like clockwork. Other times it's more random, but that's also what's happening, too.
Yes. I thought it was just that. I'm sitting there watching these two bees emerge. One, blondie and blonde, the other one just pitch black, right next to each other, just coming out of the cell.
Well, you know you have a lot of diversity. That's good.
Just means you're coming with a friend.
Yes. My guy's a girl. I like her. Yeah, that's good.
This
goose blue
is
cool.
Any other? Ask away. I'm all yours.
Group pen. On VHS. Yes, it seems. Tell me that. Tell me how I could look at that as opposed to something that's got a rude disease of some kind, a shotgun pattern, or.
That's a good question. So he's saying that with a higher expression of VSH, when you have a mite infestation, they start pulling out the brood that we saw, and you'll get sort of a shot holy pattern. My best answer to that would be, monitor that. Obviously, you're going to look at the frame and you're going to see the pupa and stuff. And, you know, if it's brood disease, you should be able to tell. Do a straw test. Or sometimes you see EFB, you know, under stressy situations. But just to monitor over time, like check it in a week, check it in a week and a half. A lot of times with the VSH behavior, they'll go in, they'll pull all that out. The queen will come back in and lay, right. And then the pattern will solidify again. But yeah, sometimes I'll go in and look at colonies and I'll think, oh man, this is terrible. What's going on here? And go about through the yards and come back, check that colony again, and it's all solid because she's backfilled it. So just keep, you know, observation is your best tool.
You mentioned earlier in the beginning of your talk about the burrow mites along with the viruses that they also are carrying. Now, with the viruses that they're carrying, some of it can be showing characteristics of a European fowl brood, but really not be European fowl brood?
I don't know about that. I do know that, and you'll have to correct me, I do know that the guys I keep in touch with, the bigger guys we make queens for, that off and on they see weird EFB-like symptoms, and then it goes away. And it's usually early in the year, and then it goes away. And I don't know whether that's from a virus or that is actually some EFB that is there and that bees haven't got enough population up to clean it up enough. So I don't know. The main virus thing, the worst virus scenario is deformed wing virus. So basically, there was deformed wing virus that was out and around before Varroa came. Varroa got here, started to parasitize bees, started to spread viruses more quickly. And what happened was, in that interaction between Varroa and the bee, the deformed wing virus changed and got to be much more lethal. So now deformed wing virus is a completely different genetically. Is that correct? Genetically, it's much different than it was pre-Varroa.
Well, that, mutated then.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that happens
That's what I was asking, because I had some that kept showing symptoms or characteristics of a European fall brood, but then when I sent it into Bellsville to get tested, it kept coming back as no virus detected.
So that's... They have
or
a name.
No European problem.
They have a name for that. This is the name. You ready? It's called idiopathic brood. And it's like, we don't know what it is. Yeah. It's an issue, but if it goes away, don't worry about it. It's like, And we see that too often. I keep an eye and I keep records on who has it, and sometimes it's everybody, sometimes it's just a few colonies. I've also seen, and this is not to open up a can of worms, so I'm not going to go into it too far, but sometimes when we have, looks like we have kills from pesticide, you know, mild, I'll see that more than the years where we don't. There's so much going on that we don't know at the low level. So, you know, maybe there's something going in there that's turning something on as making something more, you know, making the bacteria more strong, it's harder to clean up. I don't know. We don't know. But just, it's amazing, you know, just flying here, you know, flying from, it was cloudy when we left Detroit, and we flew in and we got about 30 miles out of here and came down through the clouds, and both Kelly and I gasped. It's like, it's just, I mean, I can't imagine what the spray is like here. And, you know, these guys do what they do, but I don't know what you guys do. You must have some strategies. It just, I couldn't imagine keeping bees here. It would be pretty hard. So, good for you.
Yeah. Well, that picture there that you're showing, that's more like where we live in southern Illinois.
This, mm-hmm. Yeah.
In southern Illinois, it's not flat like this. We've got hills.
More forests and stuff.
Hills and hollows and everything else.
Yeah, that's a lot. A lot of it's environmental too. It's, you know, you can have the best breeding stock, and if this happens a lot, you know, you have like a dearth and you're not on top of it and you can't go out there and check and stuff, you can have stuff that's really good and it just, in 2 weeks it can fall out. So, anything else? I mean, got plenty of time?
Record keeping. Everyone always says keep good records. Can you give me some sort of an idea of what you would consider to be good record keeping for the layperson that's not doing artificial insemination or whatever? I mean, basically, I try to buy VSH bees. I've got some that come from various sources, supposedly with their origins from you. One of the last one and the one before that I've actually verified. The other ones that, you know, I don't know how you keep this straight. If everything's open, made it here, as we're producing these things, what would work? Would be the best thing we could accomplish?
All right, I'll tell you what we do, and you could go from there. Everything that we make, every colony has a number, and the number is the year, and then an arbitrary, if it's an AI queen, it's got a number because you number them. So for this year, the queens from this year are 14, and then there's 1401 all the way up through however many we made. And then after the number, if it's an AI queen, so it wouldn't apply to you, that is kept in a book. It's also on the computer. It's who it's crossed with, what the drones were, and then if there's any comment on the insemination, like did it do well or was it hard to inseminate or did it look strange or what its coloration was like, you just have that little background because you always can use that information. This is just for the AI stuff. And then we have that. And so if someone's saying, well, these did really well, we know that that combination crossed with whatever did really well. In your situation, I would still keep a year and a number, and you can also put letters in too. Sometimes it's easier to add numbers and letters. And then
anything that is open-mated at our place, at the end there's an X. So it's whatever that queen is, so you're numbering the queen, and then X. And then the X says it's open-mated. And even though you don't have the whole picture, you have all the queen mothers. And so then say you have 1401, you got it from Joe. So 1401 Joe X through 1410 Joe X. Those are the 10 queens you got from Joe that are open-mated. That way, if you make queens from them in the future, you can have then 14 blah, 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 cross, and then you can X the drone area or whatever, and you can sort of keep track of it that way. And then it's just up to you. I mean, this thing that you have here with the numerical rating system, you could have, you know, however you want to do that, you know, you could have something like each queen in a log could have a total. So of all the rating stuff, you could have a number, or you could have, you know, your ratings and then number and then average them, and you could get an average. However you want to do it. No matter how nerdy and obsessive compulsive the record keeping seems to be, it's valuable if you're breeding. Because no matter what, I'll ask Kelly, 3 years ago, that one queen that was over there by this one that had this red mark, you know, what was that? And she'll be like, but she can look it up. And then we have that intelligence, and it's like, oh, okay. So that it will be good for this purpose. So it doesn't hurt to collect data. It's just time, but it's a good thing. It's up to you. But I would always have that. So in animal breeding, I have the dam's mean, and then if you know the sire or if you know the drone area, you can put that in. Keep track of that one.
Do you have a feedback loop system in your organization to get information back from when you send queens out? Do you have a process to get that information back so you know how you're steering your operation?
He asked, do people we make queens for, do they keep in touch with us and fill us in? The people that, I don't have a formal thing. The people that I really like to work with tell me how they do. The people that are harder to work with, I don't hear from them for 2 years, and then they say, I want to buy 5 more queens, or they say, all the queens I got from you died, will you give me credit for 5 more queens? But that doesn't happen very often. But what's really helpful is when someone who has our breeding stock says, these did really well, and I know what it is, and I can look at the cross, and then I can, from that, I can either replicate it or make a similar cross. And then the people who are really good to work with, they'll send us virgins back. You know, we'll work some deal out. They'll send us back a virgin. We know exactly what it is. It's got a little bit of genetic variation now because it's mated out. So there's some new blood there. And then we can get that and inseminate it again with known and see if that's a good combination. And that's how you make progress. Mm-hmm. And even amongst yourselves, you know, that trading back and forth is totally invaluable. Because, you know, the bigger your pool, the more chances of good combinations. So, but the feedback is, I don't know, people are strange. The really busy guys, they get their queens and I don't hear from them for a year. And then when I know the queens did well, they put in another order. If I don't hear from them after a year, I usually call them and say, did they do okay? Is there anything we can do? That kind of stuff. And then some queens, if you don't just automatically send them queens, they get mad at you. So, I don't know. But that's okay. It's fun. We also have, if anybody here makes queens, sells queens, there's a common thing that's like all queen producers have, all nuke producers, actually any bee producer. It's like the line you use when you are either sold out or the person is hard to deal with, and that's, some people say, oh, I'm sorry, we need a minimum order of 5,000. You can say that. Some guys in the American Honey Producers Association were joking about that. Yeah, yeah. 10,000 is the minimum order. Or you say, I'm sorry, we're sold out. But we usually don't do that. But if we have a few customers that are extremely high maintenance, and
that's
good way to put it.
Well, you get to a point where it's like, I just am not going to do as well for the other people spending all this time with you, so we're sold out for this. But that's very rare.
So we always tell everybody that, you know, if this queen or nuke does really, really good for you, you are a great beekeeper.
Yeah.
If this queen or nuke dies for any reason, I sold you crap. Just so we're right at the very beginning of the sale, you got to let people know this.
That's right.
You know, so that the expectation is set.
That's
right. No matter what, you know, stuff happens.
Our biggest problem with quality is queen introduction, and we'll get into that, and I'll talk about that in the second talk. And that has nothing to do with our breeding program or how we make the queens. It's how the queens are handled, and you'd be amazed at how many people kill their queens after they buy them and get them shipped UPS overnight. A very simple set of instructions, and the queens die. Hmm.
You mentioned earlier that you get queens from different producers throughout the country, and you said they usually die by August. Do you go back like the next year and get another queen from them, or do you write them off, or?
I'm just doing it to see.
Out of curiosity?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, to see what's going on. And so, okay, so I got five queens from this one producer in California that's kind of specialized, and I know who makes their breeding stock. I know who their breeder is. So in a way, I'm seeing what their breeder is doing by getting open mated queens from them and seeing how they do. Now, I don't know if the producer actually used the new stuff or whatever, but in that one example where all the stuff died by August, I thought, okay, probably what I got was some banked queens, and I was a name on a list, they pulled them out of the bank, made sure they were alive and sent them to me. And that happens. And that's, you know, a shame. But I was, you know, certainly not jumping for joy. And I don't think I would ever use those guys' queens. Not because they don't make good queens, but they're not what we use. But I wanted to check and see how they did. I was really surprised that they were so susceptible. So the one thing I could get from that is, they must treat very heavily. If they're breeding and they're producing queens and people aren't calling them up left and right, they must be treating for mites really heavily. Because in an untreated scenario with a large amount of mites around or a good dynamic flow of mites, those things just, they didn't make three frames of brood. I mean, and they were, you know, when you have a high Varroa infestation, you look in there, you see one and two and three mites on each worker. It's horrible. Mm-hmm. And that's what they look like. And I was like, okay, these are really susceptible. So,
anything else?
We're glad they died.
Yeah. All right. One more?
Yeah. These queens like this that you purchased to test them out, do you introduce those into full colony so they're running a full colony with a mite load anyway or with residual mites left over? Or do you put them in dukes and start?
I start them all as splits. So I want to see what they do. You know, so I have two frames of brood, queen in the cage, a frame of honey, get it going, watch its progress over the year.
And this is simply for mite reproduction within that colony, or you have a lot of drifting bees carrying mites around?
I don't know. Maybe a combination. Probably drifting bees. And, you know, those phoretic mites, they go back and forth. And all, you know, some of the colonies I got did okay. And then our bees were doing fine. And these just, it's just very susceptible. The USDA, when they first started the VSH program, used susceptible lines as controls for the VSH. You know, they wanted bees that didn't do well so that they could compare. And they said, you know, over time, it's harder and harder to find the purely susceptible ones because the mite resistance is starting to build up. So that's a good sign. But at one point, you know, I was like, oh, you get queens from that queen producer and they're going to die from Varroa mites because they're really susceptible. So, all right, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, lunch is ready.
We're not supposed to eat it in here, but I'm sure we're all going to eat it in here. Just be really careful not to spill, because we'd get in big trouble if we get a spill. We'd be super careful. Maybe he's going to say grace for us, and then we'll go through this door, I guess, and one or two there, and